Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have Zimbabwe's controversial anti-riot internet shutdown. The nation's high court ruled earlier this week that the government's action was illegal because only the president, and not the Minister of State for Security, has the authority to order it. But in any case, the authority's move highlights a common tactic that's been employed in recent years in order to quell local unrest. Zimbabweans were rioting because of a sudden surge in fuel prices that naturally caused the price of everything else to increase as well. And seeing as how the country is already largely impoverished as it is and previously overcame one of the world's worst hyperinflation crises a decade ago, it's understandable why people would be very upset about this. The protest eventually spiraled out of control when both the demonstrators and the security forces resorted to violence, though the situation seems to have finally calmed down as of this week. Nevertheless, the state ordered the internet to be shut down as a precautionary measure aimed at preventing provocateurs from organizing on social media and escalating the situation any more than it already had been after the security forces killed at least a dozen people. Critics allege that the government wanted to cover up its reported crimes against the people, while supporters claim that such moves were necessary in order to avert the anarchy that could follow if the unrest were to spread. Both sides have valid points. On the one hand, fellow compatriots and the international audience alike should be made aware of any state abuses that occur during crowd control operations, though on the other, circulating images and or footage of this, which might be doctored and or decontextualized for infowar purposes aimed at provoking a color revolution, could inadvertently have the effect of worsening the situation if it encourages more people to come out to the streets, which could put their lives in danger if the state really is on a violent rampage. The ideal balance would be if people obtain proof of state abuses, but then responsibly disseminated this evidence after the crisis climax. Of course, developments don't often unfold in such a reasonable way in real life, especially considering that it's impossible to enforce this behavior on any of the many participants, and that the best that can be done is making them aware of general guidelines for how to act. So long as there's social media, many states will continue to shut down the internet during times of unrest, not necessarily to cover up their alleged crimes, seeing as how evidence of them would leak out anyhow after a certain amount of time, but to prevent provocateurs from worsening the situation. For as controversial of a tactic as this may be, it should nevertheless be accepted as becoming increasingly commonplace in the future. The next one up is Italy calling out France for continuing its colonial practices in Africa. Deputy Prime Minister Luigi Di Maio, who also leads the populist coalition government's left-wing five-star movement, hit at one of the structural roots of large-scale illegal African migration to Europe by declaring that it's partly because, quote, some European countries like France never stopped colonizing Africa in their heads, end quote, elaborating that, and to quote again, there are dozens of African states in which France prints its own currency, the franc of the colonies, and with that, it finances the French public debt, end quote. He added that, and this is to quote him, if France did not have the African colonies, which it is impoverishing, it would be the 15th international economic power, and instead it is among the first for what it is doing to Africa, end quote. De Maio's provocative and likely solely rhetorical solution to this problem is for the EU and UN to sanction France, something that will probably never happen, but nevertheless succeeded in making his comments international news. While cynics might charge that he was only doing this for publicity ahead of this May's European parliamentary elections that his coalition ally Salvini is trying his best to turn into a continental-wide Euro-realist revolutionary victory, the fact of the matter is that responsible leftists, which differ from the identity politics-obsessed liberals of the EU's ruling Euro-liberal establishment like Macron, understand the need to address the structural roots of poverty and migration. Ergo, his criticisms of France's neocolonial CFA franc and the broader policy of what is commonly described as Françafrique. Paris's employment of inter-elite diplomacy between the imperial center and its nominally post-imperial African periphery has enabled it to dispatch its military forces at will to protect commercial, resource, and energy interest all across its former colonial domain in the continent. The decades-long extraction of wealth from these many developing countries has severely disadvantaged them to the point where their systemic poverty became a naturally occurring push factor that combined with the EU's economic pull to convince many desperate people to make the dangerous cross-Mediterranean journey to the northern continent. That's not to say that there aren't any freeloaders and criminals mixed in with the larger bunch, but just that it should be assumed that many of the illegal migrants are regular folks who simply can't survive in their home countries due to the proverbial deck being stacked against them because of France-Afrique. France never could have imagined that its Italian neighbor would be leading the anti-imperial charge against the treatment of its former colonial possessions, but that just goes to show how quickly European politics is changing as the Euro-realist, Euro-liberal fault line moves from east to west. Third in our countdown are the two Daesh suicide bombings that targeted U.S. troops in northeastern Syria. The attacks took place over a period of just 5 days, suggesting that they're part of a coordinated strategy being employed by the terrorists against the withdrawing American troops. The Chi Bono principle has led to many observers suspecting that the whole point is to either delay Trump's promised drawdown or inflict political damage on him at home by shaping the narrative that he's retreating in the face of what he's previously described as radical Islamic terrorism. This puts the president on the horns of a classic dilemma because there is no perfect approach to dealing with this problem, though a so-called compromise solution could be to gradually replace American troops with a combination of regional proxies and mercenaries, per the lead-from-behind strategy of outsourcing geopolitical responsibilities to like-minded partners. While one can speculate on whether the Kurds encouraged these attacks as a false flag excuse for their American patrons to continue protecting them from the Turks, or whether Trump's deep state foes had a hand in this in order to undermine his planned withdrawal, most responsible analyses would probably nevertheless conclude that Daesh likely has some so-called sleeper cells all throughout Syria and is waiting to operationalize them at opportune moments such as now in order to achieve political objectives like the two that were just described. Seeing as how it's almost impossible to discover these plots until they're already in motion, it'll be difficult to prevent reoccurrences of what just happened, and the priority should therefore be shifted to tactical responses that could be employed in the field. The two latest sleeper cell attacks targeted joint U.S.-Kurdish patrols in northeastern Syria, and while these hard military targets might remain in the crosshairs, it can't be ruled out that soft civilian ones won't soon be victimized too. In the interest of the local population security, proactive measures might have to be undertaken during certain times to limit freedom of movement and access to certain sites, though a fine line must be drawn between implementing responsible policies and imposing a national security state. These new security concerns have yet to interfere with the U.S.'s planned withdrawal because they don't require American troops to enter into force, though it should be expected that any follow-up attacks of this nature will be exploited by Trump's foes in a last-ditch infowar effort to keep boots on the ground in Syria. Our runner-up is the color revolutionary unrest in Venezuela. The Bolivarian Republic is experiencing an unprecedented crisis after the U.S. and many of its Latin American allies from the so-called Lima Group recognized Juan Guaido as the country's interim president. The 35-year-old president of the National Assembly seemingly came out of nowhere in his meteoric rise to power and symbolically declared himself the head of state on the national holiday of the 23rd of January, which commemorates the day when a Venezuelan strongman was deposed in 1958. This attempted usurpation of power came just days after the leaders of a failed low-level military mutiny called on the people to take to the streets in support of regime change. There is no doubt that what's happening right now in Venezuela is the culmination of the years-long hybrid war being waged against it by the U.S. The economic warfare of the past combined with some governmental mismanagement to produce an economic crisis that gave birth to color revolutionary unrest and terrorist stunts such as the attempted assassination of Maduro last summer by an explosive drone. The Constituent National Assembly that was elected in 2017 was the president's most prominent effort to tackle the crisis, but this legal body isn't recognized by the U.S. and its allies. Instead, they claim that Guaido's National Assembly is the only legitimate legislative force in the country, despite the Supreme Court recently ruling that all of its actions since then have been illegal. Nevertheless, their recognition of the shadow structure as the state's only official one is the pretext under which the U.S. and most of its Latin American allies recognize Guaido as the head of state after he swore himself in as president and called on the armed forces to overthrow Maduro. The military pledged loyalty to the Constitution and is therefore determined to support Maduro, but there's a very real risk that this latest color revolutionary unrest will trigger a self-sustaining cycle of hybrid war destabilization that might escalate to the level of a civil war or even a foreign intervention if this pre-planned and coordinated multilateral regime change operation succeeds. In that scenario, Venezuela would be left on its own to fend off this aggression in spite of its multipolar partnerships. Russia and China aren't capable of directly defending Venezuela, even though they voiced their support for international law. And their real national interests rest with ensuring that Caracas repays its billions of dollars of loans to them and respects the energy and military deals that were previously signed, despite not having any way of guaranteeing that will happen if Maduro is overthrown. Therefore, the most likely international outcome of his ouster would probably be that the Washington-backed coup authorities would declare those deals null and void, after which they'd likely open up the world's largest oil deposits in the Orinoco Belt to U.S. companies. The long-term repercussions are that the U.S. could challenge Russia and Saudi Arabia's OPEC Plus alliance and advance its Fortress America geopolitical project in the Western Hemisphere. At our top spot, we've got the scandal over the MAGA hat kids. America was left bitterly divided after a decontextualized video went viral last weekend portraying a group of MAGA hat-wearing Catholic high school students as unabashed racist, having the time of their lives mocking a drum-beating Native American in front of the Lincoln Memorial. But the truth turned out to be very different than how the situation was originally presented. What really happened is that these high school students were waiting for their chaperones after participating in the March for Life anti-abortion protest, but were verbally abused by members of an African-American cult called the Black Hebrew Israelites, who hurled racist, religious, and homophobic insults at them while predicting that they were all on the brink of carrying out America's next school shooting. Unmoved by the hateful rant coming from the small group of provocateurs, the students started doing school chants in order to drown out the racist. And it's in that context that Nathan Phillips moved in with his drum. Video footage from the Black Hebrew Israelite cult itself proved that Phillips determinedly approached the students while incessantly beating his drum, which they at first thought was a sign of solidarity with them, but soon realized was some sort of passive-aggressive act after he singled out Nick Sandman and epically stared him down when the boy wouldn't move out of his way and let this stranger into his crowd of colleagues. Sandman's smirk has since become famous because his supporters saw it as a peaceful act of defiance in the face of unprovoked hostility, while his opponents claimed that it somehow evinces signs of racism or at the very least cultural condescension. Whatever one's personal views are about this event, the fact of the matter is that the video footage shows an altogether different chain of events than what Phillips himself said happened, and that the mainstream media jumped on the fake news bandwagon before eventually distancing itself. The reason why the fake portrayal of what happened went viral is because the mainstream media's confirmation bias was triggered when they saw what they wanted to believe were racist, MAGA hat-wearing Catholic Christian teens taunting a defenseless Native American senior, but since that's not what happened, they want to suppress the story as much as possible because the truth is that the only racists caught on tape were the Black Hebrew Israelite cult members who spewed some of the most condemnable hate speech imaginable, but are getting a free pass from the mainstream media because of their race. That's actually the biggest problem with the story, because racism should always be condemned, no matter who the racist or the victim are. And there shouldn't ever be any double standards implemented for the sake of so-called political correctness to sweep one racist statement under the rug because of narrative convenience. That's an injustice, if there ever was one, to every victim of racism. Another less prominent issue that many folks have with how the MAGA hat story was initially reported was the mainstream media's presumption that Nathan Phillips was telling the truth and was innocent of any wrongdoing just because he's a Native American whose people were previously abused throughout U.S. history. It turned out that he lied about the students chanting, "Build that wall," and they also didn't surround him and prevent him from leaving, yet he was unquestionably believed without anyone even trying to contact the students involved, because the liberal media couldn't countenance the idea of someone in his identity category making up a story for publicity. The lesson to be learned is that everyone had the constitutional right to do what they did that day in front of the Lincoln Memorial. But an adult should never lie about the actions of innocent children and try to ruin their lives just because they are wearing hats that he disagreed with. The mainstream media should have known better, but it's also not surprising that they didn't. So folks, there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all have a nice rest of your week, and tune in again next week. Thank you. Bye.